This week on Making Contact.
We didn't know the law, we didn't know the system. And it was our daughter's life on the line. They're just taking pieces of her, you know, and we can't stop them.
I felt like just lifting her up and running and let us shoot us in the back. Get it over with.
Healthcare in prisons and jails across the U.S. is in a state of crisis. And California prisons are no exception. State officials claim medical services in California's prisons meet normal community healthcare standards. But prisoner rights activists, lawyers, healthcare workers, and the prisoners themselves have a different story to tell. The life and death of Gina Muniz is one of those stories. On the second of our three-part series, A Crisis of Care, a look inside California's prison healthcare system, we continue Gina's story. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, battle ideas, and important information.
Here's one. This was in Tacoma. It's Gina, Amanda, and me. This was our last Christmas together. Amanda's standing in the front of her mommy, and her mom's in the middle, and then I'm behind Gina with my arms around her.
Look how pretty you guys all look.
I love my daughter a lot. And my, like I say, thank God, Gina, thank you, that you left me a beautiful granddaughter too, to hug and love all over again.
That's Gina's mom, Grace, sharing pictures of her daughter. Gina was 29 when she died. She was serving a life sentence for a nonviolent crime at the Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. While she was incarcerated, Gina fell seriously ill. She was in pain, her stomach was bloated, and she began to bleed uncontrollably.
And then we have Gina here. I remember here she was going to school to be a nurse.
Is that what she always wanted to do?
Yeah, she wanted to work in the ER and help people, make them better. Gina was a very giving person, and that's why I was devastated, the way they treated her.
Yet despite pleas for medical care from both Gina and her family, 6 months passed before she was finally diagnosed with stage 2B cervical cancer. Still, it was treatable. She needed radiation treatment, chemotherapy, and a hysterectomy to save her life. But as time wore on, Gina's life sentence was quickly turning into a death sentence. I sit with Gina's mom, Grace, her stepdad, David, her brother, Larry, and her daughter, Amanda, at their home in Calamasa, California, a small middle-class city about an hour and a half east of Los Angeles. They share stories and pictures of a daughter, a sister, and a mom they all love and miss. Grace continues Gina's story, recalling the last year of her daughter's life.
This is the year 2000. My daughter started getting chemo and radiation. After chemo and radiation, they would stop the bleeding, and they would put her in a holding cell until somebody else would come out from Women's and Children's Hospital and transfer her back to Twin Towers.
Gina had originally been sent to Chowchilla on a life sentence, charged with kidnapping and robbery. But that sentence was tossed out after the family filed an appeal. Grace's family argued that Gina's first attorney had lied to her about the plea bargain he had arranged. Gina thought she pled to 7 years, but while in prison, found out she had signed off on a life sentence. With misrepresentation proved, a judge ruled in Gina's favor. She was transferred back to Los Angeles County's Twin Towers Jail, where she awaited a trial. But the complex and often mysterious dealings with the criminal justice system were taking its toll on the family.
Because we didn't know the law, we didn't know the system. And it was our daughter's life on the line, her time, her livelihood. My son David's sister, Larry's sister, Amanda's mother, Grace's daughter, my daughter. You know, they're just taking pieces of her, you know, and we can't stop them.
That's Gina's stepfather, David. A lithographer by trade, he co-owns a trucking business with Grace.
We never got no breaks, other than getting the appeal, but I don't know if, you know, did the appeal help? Because by the time we got her back for the appeal, that's when she got sick on us, and then we found she had cancer.
Gina finally began treatment at Los Angeles County University of California Medical Center, but things weren't going well.
And my daughter would call me devastated, and she would say, they want me in bed rest right away after chemo and radiation, and the officers here at Twin Towers are going against doctor's orders, and they're putting me downstairs in the basement at Women's and Children's Hospital, and I'm already bleeding, Mom, because there's no blankets, there's nothing. She was on a concrete on a bed with a pillow. And my daughter's running fever. And I remember calling the lieutenant, and I would call them and tell them, why are you going doctors against doctor's orders? You need to talk to your officers. My daughter, Gina, has a note.
That note, written by a county doctor, gave deputies specific orders to send Gina back to her unit at Twin Towers to rest. Oftentimes, that didn't happen. Instead, she was placed in a holding cell along with others waiting to be transported back to jail, about 4 miles away. Grace says Gina would often continue to bleed after treatment. Court documents show, one time in particular, she began to hemorrhage badly. A corrections officer would later confirm that Gina had to sit on the toilet to manage the blood loss. As part of a deposition for a lawsuit the family was filing, that deputy was questioned about how she handled Gina's care. She says she couldn't confirm when, how, or even if the medical staff had attended Gina. What she did remember is the on-call nurse's comment about Gina. She was the one who, quote, was always bleeding from her vagina. Knowing that her daughter was being denied the medical treatment she needed, Grace continued her fight to stay in contact with her daughter and those who were charged with providing proper medical care.
Well, this went on for almost 7 weeks. I went to visit her again, and I said, Gina, what's wrong? After your chemo and radiation, and you should be looking better. And she goes, I know, Mom. She goes, but I don't feel good. I don't feel good. And I go, you don't look good. You look so pale. She looked white, white. And that wasn't her color. She looked sick. And I called the lieutenant, and I said, something's wrong with my daughter. And they went and checked up on her, and they found out she had pneumonia.
Grace says it started with a cold, brought on by the cold showers Gina was forced to take, despite her frail condition and continued blood loss.
That's why she got sick. And she goes, Mom, that water's so cold. And I tell them, and they don't listen to me.
Because her immune system is already basically shot because of the chemo. Mm-hmm. So she had no defense.
Yeah. And I wrote them a letter to the prison staff and the medical and to the lieutenant. And I told them the way they were abusing my daughter after her chemo and radiation. And they wrote me back and they said that they didn't find nothing wrong with it. And that she'll continue to shower, that's all they put. But then when my daughter talked to me, she said, Mom, thank you so much. And they would tell her, what are you gonna do, call your mother and complain again? And she goes, yeah, my mother's my voice. And they would get mad at her because she would call me.
A routine of chemotherapy and radiation treatments, shuttling back and forth between facilities, cold prison showers, and hours spent in holding cells, all were taking their toll on Gina's fading health. Still, preparations for her trial were moving forward. Key to the case was testimony from the 51-year-old woman who Gina had technically kidnapped and forced to withdraw $200 from an ATM. At the time, Gina was struggling with a crack addiction brought on by depression over her biological father's death. That addiction began when a close relative encouraged Gina to take the drug to ease her pain, at first buying it for her, and then later demanding sex as payment. Gina eventually broke away from him, but still needed to feed her addiction. It was in this state of mind that Gina, unarmed, had kidnapped and robbed the woman. The woman did not want to prosecute. She wanted Gina to get help. At a pretrial hearing, she approached Grace.
I seen the woman in the hallway. I was crying in the hallway and she went up to me. And she wasn't supposed to talk to me. She said, why don't they put her in a rehab? And I told her, you know, I said, when you get on the stand, why don't you ask them that? Because that's what we want for Gina. Well, then she got up there and they asked her, do you know anybody in this courtroom? And she looked around, has anybody threatening you or anything? You know, all these questions they ask. And that lady said, no, nobody's threatening me. Okay, we want you to point out Gina Muniz and my daughter's handcuff and shackle sitting next to her lawyer. And the lady goes, she's right there. And she pointed. And she pointed to the court interpreter. And this court interpreter was wearing a dress and a skirt. And they looked at it, the lady. Angry, and they said, you need to look around again and point Gina Muniz out, the one late girl that took you for the 200. And the lady said, that's her again, the court interpreter. And she said that was her. And then the DA got really mad And he slammed the file on the desk and said, okay, excused. So I said, oh, thank you, Lord, they're going to release my daughter.
But a release for Gina was not going to happen. Despite the lack of cooperation by her victim, Gina's case went to trial. And despite the fact that this was a nonviolent crime and that she had no weapon, she was still convicted.
They found her guilty of the kidnapping, and they didn't find her guilty of a gun or a knife. And they gave her life plus 7 years and 8 months. I had told the court that my daughter was sick and she needed a hysterectomy to not remove her, please. They said no, that they were going to send her to prison.
And not keep her at Twin Towers.
Right, that she would get the best medical in the prison that she was going to.
I always felt this was going to pass. This nightmare was going to end and she'd be home to us. And we can get on with our life. You know, we can get back. Amanda would have her mother, and Dave would have his sister, Larry would have his sister, and we would be back doing our family things.
Instead, she was sent back to Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla, or CCWF, a facility that was successfully sued for its insufficient and negligent medical care.
And then after, when she went to Chowchilla, I went to visit her, and she goes, Mom, she said, the girls are saying in here that there's no medical in here. And I said, Gina, I said, that can't be true. I said, there has to be medical in here. This is the state of California, Gina. You will get medical. Don't believe what the girls are saying.
Grace once again became Gina's voice to the system that was not listening.
I called the doctors and I told them my daughter had cancer. I had the letter that I certified to the warden, to the doctors, to the officers, to her counselor, and say my daughter needs a hysterectomy. She finished her chemo radiation, she needs a hysterectomy. Well, then my daughter, about a month later, went by, still no doctors, nothing, no one seen her. I would travel 4 hours to get to Chowchilla. Every weekend I was there. And my daughter, I seen her deteriorating more and more, and the doctors kept, they would tell me that she was getting seen by a doctor. My daughter would say, it's not true, Mom.
What was true was Gina's quickly fading health. David remembers all too well what the cancer was doing to his daughter.
We could see her deteriorating every time. You know, first time she's okay, a mom, you know, and then we see her next time, she's kind of walking a little different. The next time, towards the end, she's in a wheelchair. She can't be getting better.
And I'm like, Gina, what's wrong? And me is still saying it's going to be okay, but you can't be in a wheelchair, get up. And she's, Mom, I can't walk no more. I have a lot of pain. And I go, haven't you been seen? They told me last week they were going to see you. She goes, no, I haven't seen anybody. She said, I can't even walk no more. I have a lot of pain.
By September 2000, Gina still hadn't received the hysterectomy. That was 8 months after the cancer was found. Eventually, she was taken to CCWF's on-site medical facility. Grace would have to wait to see her daughter, but was reassured by correction officers.
She was eating Miss Ortega. She's fine. I just seen Gina having lunch, so I'm thinking, oh, great, she's getting better. They're going to give my daughter her hysterectomy. Well, and then something told me when I went to bed that something was very wrong, because they wouldn't let me see my daughter now, because she's in the medical facility. They said you have to wait 3 weeks before they give you a visit. And so then I called Lucy Armadares. She's an Osmond woman. If you're having problems in the prison, you talk to her. And I called her and I said, Lucy, I need to see my daughter. They're telling me she's okay, but I feel something's wrong.
And then when we went up there and we went up to the prison, and they said she was fine walking around, and Grace just had a gut feeling she was bad. And when we got up there, they told her, well, she's not here. She's in. They took her to the hospital.
It turns out Gina's condition had worsened. She was taken to Madera Community Hospital, just down the street from Chowchilla. Grace and David rushed over there, but were met with resistance and some very bad news.
They had a gang of sheriffs waiting for us in front of the hospital, thinking we were going to escape or break her out or something. And then we got there, and they're saying that they're holding us back and said, you know, we just want to see her, where she at. And
I asked to talk to the doctor, and he came out and he said my daughter was in very critical condition, that they had brought her last night at 8 o'clock. And he said, and she was just hanging on. He said, but if she lives within the 24 hours, you're going to be a very lucky parents. He told me that she had a bubble on her leg and it could travel to her heart, and that the cancer didn't look good, but that he had to do other testings. and that her kidneys were shutting down. And I asked that I needed to see my daughter, and they were saying, the doctor goes, they won't let you see her. There's been women here that come, the mothers, when their daughters are very sick. Why they bring them to this prison and hanging by a thread for their life, I don't know, Miss Ortega, but this is how they bring him here, very critical, ready to die.
This is standard procedure. Gina was still a ward of the state. Grace would have to navigate the state bureaucracy before she could see and hold her daughter. And she did. After signing the papers and finally receiving approval from the warden, Grace made her way to her daughter's bedside. She wasn't prepared for what she'd find.
I walked in there and I seen my daughter. When she see me, she said, Mom, how did you find me? And she was handcuffed and her leg was shackled to the bed too, to the rail. And she had all these IVs on her and her leg was swollen. And her hair, it was matted. And I told her, Gina, I'll always find you. You're never going to be too far from me. And she looked at me and she said that she wanted to know how her daughter was. And I told her Amanda was fine. And she had just left with my husband because I was spending the night there. I said, I'm not leaving you. I'm bringing you home. And how I was going to bring her home with that life sentence, I don't know. But I knew God was going to help us.
The decision was easy. Determined to bring her home, Grace was going to move near her daughter. That meant for the next 3 months, David would become the primary caretaker for their family in Cala Mesa. The stark reality that Gina might never come home was beginning to sink in. And if she did, it would be on what is termed a compassionate release, to essentially come home to die. As her health continued to fade, Gina was transferred to Doctors Medical Center in Modesto. No one knew for sure just how sick she was, but they were about to find out.
The doctor came in, and Dr. Rocky, he's a cancer specialist, and that's when he said, Gina, I need to talk to you. And he goes, do you want your mom here, or do you want me to tell you by yourself? And Gina said, no, we're in this together, me and my mom. My mom needs to know whatever you need to tell me. It's okay. So then that's when he said, Gina, I have some bad news for you. You have 3 to 6 months to live because the cancer has spread. And me and Gina looked at each other, and she just put her head up and she started singing Amazing Grace. And the doctor walked out. And then she hugged me and I hugged her, and she was still shackled to the bed, handcuffed. And they had an officer 24/7 standing by the door with their guns, and two officers all the time. And my daughter's handcuffed to the bed and her ankles. And when they said she had 3 to 6 months to live, I was just like, I can't take this no more, Lord.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to part two of A Crisis of Care.
I remember when she was there at the hospital, they had her handcuffed to the bed in Modesto. They had already told us that she had 3 to 6 months to live because the cervical cancer had spread. And the doctor said, I'm so sorry, there's nothing I can do for Gina. So after he left, we cried. And then Gina asked me if I can go get a camera. And I said, what do you want the camera for?
As we sit by the fireplace, Grace pulls out a photograph of Gina's emaciated body, shackled to a bed at Modesto Community Hospital. Looking at the picture, you can see how much she suffered. The face is that of a much older woman, frail-looking, IVs in her arm. Dark circles frame her downcast eyes. Her right arm tenderly cups the head of her then 8-year-old daughter, Amanda. Her left arm is handcuffed to her hospital bed. Why? the Department of Corrections requires that even terminally ill patients be shackled and guarded 24 hours a day.
She said, "Mom, I need you to take a picture of me and my daughter so the world could see that there is no medical in jail, and the way they treat us worse than dogs." And I said, "Gina, this is very hard for me to do, and especially a picture." And she said, "Mom, please, that's my wish." I said, "What do I do with the picture after?" And she said, "Well," she said, "after you take it," she said, "and I go with God, I want you to show this picture of me and my daughter, how they have the women in prison, because I don't want people could be very judgmental and say, oh, it's just a grieving mother and angry because she's exaggerating, this can't happen in the prison." And she said she wanted the world to see how the women are treated. So I did. I went to the drugstore and I came back and I took the picture of Gina. And it was very devastating to know that this picture, what it was going to be used for, especially my daughter and my granddaughter in this picture hugging and knowing that it's not going to be long that my daughter was going to die.
During this time, Grace and her family filed for a compassionate release. It allows the early release of someone who is terminally ill so they may spend their last days with loved ones. They're rarely granted. In fact, between 1991 and February of 2008, 70% of those requested were denied. But the family was determined to bring Gina home. Grace was in contact with the director with legal services for prisoners with children, a San Francisco-based advocacy group. They were going to help draft the compassionate release.
Well, then Donna had got a hold of me because I had certified these letters that what they were doing to my daughter. And they have a lot of the women, they work in the, go in there and they investigate why is the prison denying women medical, or just, they stay in contact to try to help these women to serve their time and come out alive.
Make sure that their basic human rights are being
yes.
met.
Donna had called me and she said she wanted to talk to me and that she had received the letter. And then, so we talked for a long time and I told her everything. And she said, "Well, you hang in there because we're going to join you and we're going to get Gina home."
For the first time in 3 years, the family felt hopeful. The fact that they were now fighting for the simple right to have Gina die at home was not lost on them, of course. They were going to lose her, and they knew it. But her death would not happen in a prison hospital ward. Gina would not take her last breath while handcuffed to a hospital bed. Not if Grace could help it.
I seen a light in the end of the tunnel, and I said, "They're going to help me bring Gina home. There is hope now. Someone who cares." And we had a hearing date. And well, and then we started fighting for a compassionate release for Gina. And Donna had warned me. She had said, "Grace," she said, "I want to warn you." She said, "I understand Gina's sick and she doesn't have much to live, but I need to tell you." And they were so honest from the very beginning. Never hid nothing from me. She said, "I know it's going to be painful, but there's a possibility they'll deny Gina to come home."
And so once again, for the last time, the family was in a courtroom on Gina's behalf.
So then we went to the compassionate release and I spoke on behalf of my daughter. You can never, when you go there, you cannot talk about why you were treated in court the way you were. You can't talk about those things. So all we had to just focus on getting my daughter home, why we think she should come home. And this is what Donna told us, and we did that.
We never got nothing to go our way. Ultimately, in the last thing of all this hardship and trauma and hurt and unbelievable things that could happen to a family, to my family, here at the end of all this tragedy and all the hurt and sorrow and the pain and the drama and trauma and of all this that happened to the last, I'd say, 3 years during that time, we went 3 years of this, it comes down to these stone faces to let our daughter go.
It was a family's plea for some final bit of dignity for the woman who was a daughter, a sister, a mother, and now a neglected cancer patient.
And I always remember seeing Gina through the glass, and she says, "You're gonna get me home, right, Pops? You're gonna get me home? They're gonna yell at me, huh? We're gonna get you home." I looked it right in her eyes, and she's like, her eyes like a little puppy. "We're gonna get you home. We'll get you home."
And we we talked about how my daughter was deteriorating by the minute, and we need to get her home. And we weren't allowed to say it wasn't a heinous crime. They just read her file. So they knew that my daughter wasn't this monster, what they made her out to be in the courtroom. And they told us to wait about an hour before we had an answer. So we all prayed together, and Donna was there and still, and saying, it's gonna be okay, Grace. No matter what the outcome, we did all we could. And I said, no, my daughter's coming home. I know she is, and I felt it. And when we went back, they said, yes, she's been released. And I just felt like running all the way to the hospital and carrying my daughter home. I just felt like running to her and just saying, we're free, finally we're free. It was just, as sad as it was, because my daughter was dying, it was a happy, very happy day for me. One of the happiest days in my life that I prayed for since 1998. When my daughter got in trouble. Finally, she was coming home, and it was so sad because her condition, but she was coming home to die with us. And when I told her, Gina, you're home, you're coming home, she just started crying. And she was so sick, and she knew she was, she told me, I know, Mom. And she gave me the biggest smile, and I just hugged her.
Gina went home on November 27th, 2000. On the 28th, she began slipping away.
Then the next day, at 12:45, my daughter passed away. She went home to Jesus. I remember when I asked the nurse, is my daughter leaving us? Because her eyes started getting kind of cloudy. And she said, yes. And I had my granddaughter and my son, and we all went in the room, and Amanda was holding her mommy's hand, and my son was holding her other hand, and I had my arms around her. And I remember whispering in her ear and telling her, it's okay, go with Jesus now. Everything's gonna be okay. Be at peace, my daughter. And she did, and she passed away right there at 12:45 on a Wednesday, November 29th.
Coming up on A Crisis of Care.
What we have to struggle for is a socially just society where healthcare is a right and not a commodity and not available to a few people.
The culture of the prisons is as horrid as the medical care, and is one of the reasons for how bad the medical care is, because basically the body politic in California and the general public just don't care.
Please join us for part 3 of A Crisis of Care. Many thanks to all of the people who contributed their time, energy, and support to this show, especially to freelance audio producer Mike Lamar, to Matt Fidler of Fidler Sound and Media, who wrote and produced the music for this show, and to Steve Macer for editing assistance. Much appreciation to the Omnia Foundation, who helped make this show possible, and to Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast crew. For a CD copy of program number 1408, please call 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer, producer, Puck Lowe, associate producer, Elena Bakken-Levy, intern, and I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.